Coming back into our topic of breathing, speaking of breathing. So for the last few weeks, we've looked at some of the technical aspects of breathing practice, and we've begun to stitch together the instructions on breathing in the early Buddhist lineage, primarily the initial instructions in the Anapanasati Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 118. You can go find that sutta. The instructions on Anapanasati, or mindfulness of in and out breathing. Anapana is in and out, and sati is mindfulness, or intimacy with, if you like. The initial instructions on Anapanasati begin with awareness of long breaths, awareness of short breaths, awareness of the whole body, and relaxing or softening the body. And I think this is such a beautiful foundational set of instructions for coming into breathing practice. And I interpret them as directions for initially a kind of volitional breath. So I will very, very often, almost always, begin a meditation with some number of long breaths, and then relaxing the breath to a short natural breath. And when I say natural breath here, I'm really thinking about a breath where I'm not pulling on the musculature at all. And so really relaxing the belly, relaxing through the postural musculature, and relaxing the diaphragm even, the big dome at the base of our ribs that pulls the breath in and out. Relaxing through all of that and inclining further towards stillness will very naturally shorten the breath. And this can, this is really like a long slide toward deepening stillness. So the long breath kind of brings in energy, gathers up some force, really sets up the field of energy in the body, and then relaxing that to short breaths, refocusing concentration on a short breath. Often the short breath is quite shallow, actually. And as concentration deepens, it can get even shallower and shorter. Not always, but it can. And you don't need to force it to do that either. You really can just let it go and focus on stillness. From there, the third breath is to breathe aware of the whole body. And we talked a couple weeks ago about the old commentarial controversy about what that exactly means. I go with Tanisaro Bhikkhu of Wat Metta and my teacher Eugene Cash and others who understand that to mean feeling the whole body breathing. And so what I'll do is I'll mix the awareness of breath that I've been cultivating with the awareness of posture that we began the sitting with. And those two focuses brought together can often give rise to the sense of the whole body breathing. And you can feel the breath coming in and out through the skin of the arms and legs sometimes, through the back of the body, in addition to the breath of air in and out of the lungs. And then the fourth step is to relax the body. And generally the commentaries suggest that this means deepening in stillness. Some of the commentaries suggest that this is pointing toward the profound stillness of what's called fourth jhana, or it's a very deep absorption state where the physical breath can stop entirely or almost entirely, can become imperceptible because so much stillness has become absorbed into the body and the mind is tremendously still. So this can really just be a foundation of setting up a field of energy that then becomes more concentrated, more still, more relaxed. But it can stay with the sense of the whole body. A really interesting guideline that Tanisaro Bhikkhu sometimes gives is the astute noticing that when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing with the whole body, so you have a sense of the whole body all at once, and you can feel the whole body breathing, and it can kind of feel almost like even out from the body a couple of feet, like the whole field around the body, it has its own kind of breath pulsation. That when the mind wanders a little or concentration weakens, focus weakens, often what will happen is the sense of that expanse will shrink. So the sense of what's breathing can kind of snap back to just being the belly moving or the air coming in and out of the nose. You can begin to notice that, and that can even be a sign that focus is wavering. And so one of the things that we can work to maintain actually is not just awareness of the breath, like the witnessing of it, but really the felt sense of the energy of the whole body being fairly spacious, being gently pressed outward, so that there's a sense even of the body being large with energy. And you can really work this. You can, if you know perhaps the image or the simile for first jhana, the beginning of deep concentrated absorption, the images of a bath attendant kneading water into a ball of bath powder. So you have a bunch of powder in its dry form, it's loose. You want to make it into a ball to be used in the bath. And so you sprinkle water on it slowly, kneading it just like you would knead bread dough, you know, that you want it to all stick together, but you don't want it to drip or be too soggy that it falls apart. So you're kneading the sense of awareness and the sense of breathing, which is the anchor for awareness, into the whole body. And you're making sure that all the parts of the sphere of the body are saturated with this energy. And so you can feel like, oh, maybe there's a whole numb area somewhere back here, up here, down here, out there. You can find patches in the body or around the body where you can't feel the breathing energy as much. And you can actually direct your attention there where attention goes, you can say sensation or energy flows. So if there's a numb area in the body or around the body, you can just notice that and then give your attention to that. See what's there. Sometimes there's an emotion there that wants to be met and held. Sometimes there's an absence there that wants to be held with compassion. You can do all of this very gently. This is a very gentle pranayama, but it is a sense that we're not just passively watching the breath as if from some distance, but there's really a cultivating of a rich, moist, energetic sense of the body and the field of energy in the body. That is, that energy is breath, right? Prana means both breath and energy. So with this as a foundation, the further cultivation of energy can be thought of as, you know, a fleshing out or a building out on these first couple instructions of the long breath and the short breath. In the Hatha Yoga traditions, there's substantial use of the breath as a cultivator of energy. We talked about last week a little bit the origin, maybe it was last week, maybe it was the week before, about the origin of Hatha Yoga. The word Hatha means forceful, literally. There's a secondary meaning that a lot of people really like now. It appears in one particular commentarial text somewhat later. Hatha Yoga begins in about the 11th or 12th century. The word starts to be used initially in Himalayan texts, both from the Buddhist and Shaiva lineages. So Hatha Yoga, well, some of the earliest texts of the Hatha Yoga tradition are Buddhist, Tantric Buddhist from the Himalayas. So that feeds into like Tibetan practice, Vajrayana practice, Bon practice. And those texts and practices weave with practices cultivated in the Kashmir Valley, primarily by Shaiva practitioners or devotees of the god Shiva, and this will eventually be absorbed into devotional Hinduism, Tantric Hinduism. And so the beginnings of Hatha Yoga are really shared by the Buddhist and early Hindu traditions, Tantric traditions on both sides. So neither tradition is the sole owner of Hatha Yoga. And Hatha Yoga, many of the texts themselves actually very specifically say that these are pragmatic energy practices. They're not in and of themselves devotional or philosophical. And so they can be practiced by anyone. And one of the texts says, you know, even Buddhists can do these. And of course, a whole different text is like, you know, they come from Buddhists. So so just a bow to the shared origin lineage of Hatha Yoga. The word Hatha specifically means forceful, and it probably means forcing breath energy into the central column to awaken Kundalini, the coiled goddess. But a somewhat later text spins the syllables of Ha and Ta to mean sun and moon. And so that's a kind of esoteric interpretation referring to the union of opposites. The sun generally referring to the right side of the body, and the moon generally referring to the left side of the body, and the energetic channels of Pingala, the red or fiery or sun-oriented channel on the right, and Ida, the moon channel on the left. These are the Sanskrit names, so most often used in the Hindu yogas. The Tibetan system has the same two side channels. They have their Tibetan names. I'll stick with the familiar Sanskrit ones for now. So you have this tradition that develops of really working with the breath to shape the energy that awareness is at play with in the body, around the body, through the emotional body, through the whole sense of awareness and who we are. And the tradition of Hatha Yoga in both its Buddhist and Hindu forms developed a huge proliferation of breathing practices, but stripped down, they come to a few basic principles. And the basic principles are that lengthening the exhale is supportive for calm, focus, tranquility, deactivation out of nervous system states, we might say in modern language. And then emphasizing the inhale is helpful for uplifting energy, bringing in force, moving energy through the body, heating things up. Generally, in the yogic traditions, there's a preference toward calm, because calm is the supportive condition for samadhi, for the gathered or unified heart-mind. And so pranayama in all of the traditions tends to focus on two main things. One is ratios of the inhale and exhale that either balance them or emphasize the exhale. So like a preparatory practice that we did today in the meditation would be to inhale for a certain length and then exhale the same length. This is a practice called samavritti. Sama means equal or balanced. Vritti is turning. So equal turning breath. Samavritti. You can extend this into equal lengths of not just inhale and exhale, but also equal lengths of holding at the top or bottom or both. If you do all of those, you get what's sometimes called a box breath, where you might inhale for five, hold for five, exhale for five, and hold for five at the bottom. ratios of inhaling and holding and exhaling and holding can emphasize balance, like those models, or they will generally emphasize a longer exhale. So the one we did today in the meditation after the first balanced breath was inhaling for however many and then exhaling for longer. And you can work up to twice as long of an exhale as an inhale. I tend to be a pretty relaxed teacher of these things, like not all about numbers. So I'm a little like, inhale a nice amount and then exhale longer a nice amount. Some people are really particular about, like, you know, like Dr. Andrew Weil got famous for being like, inhale for 4, hold for 7 and exhale for 8. And I'm like, hold for 7 and exhale for 8. Like, sure, but I don't actually know why that exactly is special. The exhale is twice as long as the inhale. That's great. But I have no idea why the hold should be 7 rather than 8. Maybe somebody knows, you can send me a link, whatever. But mostly, it's not that precise. It's really about some of the traditions, particularly some of the South Asian traditions, particularly, you know, really get into the numbers. And like at the back of BKS Iyengar's Light on Yoga, you can find entire charts of, like, in the first week of practice, you know, inhale this, hold this, exhale this, and the numbers just increase very slightly. It's this whole diagram. I just glaze over when I look at the diagram, like, you know. Mostly, I think the feeling is this. Inhaling, the inhale is not that long. The contemporary neuroscience principle is actually that many of us, in many of the kinds of activities we do, we don't need as much oxygen as we think we do. And we actually need to balance oxygen and carbon dioxide a little more intentionally. And so some folks, especially when there's anxiety, you know, or other kinds of nervous system disruptions, can tend to overbreathe, to actually take long breaths in an attempt to calm down, but it actually can have the opposite effect. And some of this was discovered in the mid, as far back as the early 20th century, but then accelerating into the mid 20th century with some scientists working with folks who had asthma, who would gasp for breath, and folks who would have panic attacks also gasping for breath. And in both cases, the discovery that instead of trying to help these folks get a full breath, the thing to do was actually interrupt the in-breath about halfway and take a really long exhale. In other words, get a little bit less oxygen in and more carbon dioxide. So when you're exhaling, you're letting go of carbon dioxide, but you're also not taking in new oxygen. And so the longer exhale and the breath hold actually increase the amount of carbon dioxide in your system. Carbon dioxide is part of what presses your circulation to bring blood back up to the heart and bring more oxygen in. And it can be, it's just as important to have enough carbon dioxide circulating in your system as it is to have enough oxygen. And there is actually some danger in having too much oxygen. So all the old yogic systems seem to have been onto that. And so none of them emphasize taking super long inhales, with a couple exceptions. I'll speak to those in a moment. Mostly the inhale is like a medium length inhale. And then the hold, of course, doesn't bring in any more oxygen, but it really processes whatever you've got going on, and just lets everything float while you're holding, and you can deepen in stillness there. And then the long exhale really is, in a certain way, a hack to suggest to the nervous system that it's time to relax, that it's time to deactivate from whatever stress or vigilance or activation, whatever sympathetic arousal, fight or flight or fawn it was engaged in, and that it's actually time to relax. So the long exhale is a simulation of sighing, you know, Animals in the wild and humans after stressful moments will often do a thing where they take like a couple quick inhales and then a long exhale. And that becomes a pattern for yogic breathing. I'll speak to that pattern also in a moment. But the basic instruction for inhaling to balance and then cultivate calm is, you know, inhaling like half or three quarters full, but you don't need to push the inhale. Hold if you like, and then a long exhale. And the long exhale is really teaching the system the pleasure of just letting go and softening, letting go of effort. And even a few of those extra long inhales will begin to just change the state, to shift the sense of stress in the nervous system. It can shift toward calm. If you push it too hard, if you're like, I'm going to really do it, I'm going to like do a super long exhale, you're actually increasing muscular tension. You don't ever want to go to the point where there's the sense of like needing to gasp for air in pranayama. If you're doing super long holds or super long exhales, and you feel like you need to take some quick breaths in between rounds, then I would say the hold was too long or the exhale was too long. You really want to be able to find a rhythm that you could do several times without gasping. The hold at the bottom of the breath is really interesting and is often quite a beautiful place in mindfulness of breathing practice. Some folks will find that at the end of the exhale, if you really let there be a pause at the bottom, it's such an interesting stillness that often the mind will go right along with it and just pause quite deeply at the bottom of the exhale. And I generally don't do super long holds at the bottom, but you can. And there's ways that that can be really interesting, just holding really until you feel like you need to take the next breath. The hold at the bottom that I find personally really delightful is to land at the bottom of the breath and then to let go of all effort, but to gently lean away from the habit of breathing in right away and just really wait for the impulse to breathe in to arise on its own. And you can wait for the growing of a little bit of what's sometimes called breath hunger. We really want the inhale, and then that'll grow on its own. And you don't need to resist it much. You can just sort of hang out with that for a little bit and then let the natural inhale come in. And again, don't do it so long that you're gasping, but just a little kind of lingering at the bottom there. And because you're really empty of breath, and the musculature hasn't engaged to pull breath in yet, this is really a resting place throughout the breathing apparatus, and it can be a hint toward the mind of what profound stillness really feels like. Sometimes if you're doing the Anapanasati practice and the breath is just getting kind of short and shallow on its own, it's almost like you're hanging out in the vicinity of that bottom of the breath hold. There's just a tiny little wobbly breath going on, and things are getting very, very still. And that can actually be just a lovely doorway into deepening and stillness. And you can let, the main way to let that deepen and continue is just to relax into it and just let it happen. Not be worried about breathing in. And it'll happen on its own. And so in integrating some of this into seated meditation practice, one of the ways you can do this is do some round of pranayama at the beginning of a sitting. So you could do the Anapanasati sequence, long breaths, short breaths, whole body, relax. That's often a really lovely first step. You might choose to do other kinds of pranayama if you feel like it would be helpful for you to need some energy into the ball of your being, more before you settle into one of the more passive mindfulness practices, you know, just observing the breath or resting in open awareness or doing the kind of vipassana where you're aware of different things arising, labeling them perhaps, or body scanning, any of the more observational practices that we often do in the insight tradition, the Buddhist tradition. Particularly if you notice, for instance, the two energetic hindrances. Remember, the five hindrances are sensual desire and ill will. I think of those as kind of the first emotional hindrances, big versions of grasping and aversion. The third and fourth, sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry, I think of as the energetic hindrances, right? Excessive low energy, excessive high energy. So if you have either of those hindrances strongly, pranayama can be actually a wonderful support. So if energy is excessively low, there's some sloth and torpor. Sloth is technically laziness, so that's like emotional low energy, and torpor is physical low energy. You might choose a pranayama that works toward balancing the energy, like the Samavritti practice, equal inhales and exhales. Or you might choose a practice, if your torpor is really torporous, you might choose a practice that uplifts the energy quite a bit more. And so here's one of those. This is a version of, there's a bunch of different versions of this breath. There's several Tibetan variations of it that are all part of the Tummo or inner heat practice. There's a version of it used in contemporary time by a teacher named Wim Hof, who also likes immersing the body in ice water. That'll wake you up. There's a bunch of different versions of this. They all consist of a full inhale and then an extra inhale. And part of what this does is the full inhale, diaphragm presses, a big diaphragm breath, diaphragm presses down, lungs inflate. They're relatively full, and then, or they're kind of full to a sort of habitual fullness. And then you take an extra full breath. A really nice way to do this is to lay down so that the first full breath really fills the belly and the low ribs, and then the extra breath really pops the upper ribs, like inflate, and you get into all the little pockets of the upper lungs. In a way, this is like a fast version of a yogic breath where you breathe in and fill the belly and the ribs and then all the way up to the top of the ribs. But you do it in two inhales. So full inhale and then an extra inhale to really push the top. And then a full exhale. And the exhale is not particularly long. So a shorter exhale and then more inhaling, and it'll bump your energy up. Some folks do this through the mouth. I prefer breathing in through the nose almost entirely. If you do the whole thing through the mouth, your mouth will dry out. It's not that great for a bunch of things in your cranial architecture, but it will stir up the energy. It actually stirs up the sympathetic nervous system a little bit, because mouth breathed air is less filtered and colder, and that's actually startling to the nervous system. So it's very gently scaring your system that it's doing something unhealthy, which is partly why it stirs up emotion. But a big breath through the nose and then breathing out through the mouth is okay for this one. So this is like, I've got a lot of torpor, I need to whip it up. I'm going to do a breath like this. I might do just a few of these. And of course, if you're on retreat in a hall full of lovely, quiet people, don't go outside to do this, or do it in your room before you come in the morning. But it might look something like, sound something like this. So the Wim Hof people, they do like 30 rounds of that, and then hold at the top, and then hold at the bottom, and then do several rounds of that whole thing lying down. If you do all of that 30 rounds of a big breath like that, hold the breath out, and then do the whole thing again and the whole thing again 4 or 5 times, you will get lit for sure. And some folks super love that. Some folks super do not love that. It can stir stuff up. So if you've got old traumas, you know, just be aware that if you bring a bunch of energy in, energy comes into everything. And so whatever you've got going on can get stirred up. But it will definitely wake you up, and it's not harmful. It's good for lots of folks, but not everyone. So those kinds of breaths and variations of those breaths are used in things like holotropic breathwork and other things. So gentle versions of waking up the body might include, and these you can do like in the meditation hall with other folks around, might include things like, you know, really filling out the sense of energy with the inhale and then holding and using the hold to just spread the energy through the whole body. You can do this even with not a super long inhale. You really fill it out, and then in the hold, you might bring back the sense of the whole body and really let the breath energy like almost like permeate or soak out through to everything. And if you really want to wake it up again, you could keep the hold quite long and the exhale not quite as long. So you're really emphasizing bringing in some energy and holding it and moving it all the way through. So you can use the inhale and the hold and faster breathing to wake yourself up, to bring some energy into the system. And then we talked mostly before about the calming. So if you've got a lot of restlessness and worry, again, worry is the kind of cognitive aspect, restlessness is the somatic. Any of the pranayamas, again, that balance, so samavritti, or the longer exhales, can be really just delightful in that. You can, interestingly, you can do a gentler version of this double breathing with a longer exhale to have more of a deactivating or calming effect. A different teacher right now, neuroscientist Andrew Huberman, who's kind of a popular YouTuber on health and other things, calls this the physiological sigh. But it's essentially the same breath, but a little slower. Inhaling, and then a second inhale, and then just a soft, relaxed exhale through the mouth. And so there's a way that it like, it bumps up your energy a little and then softens the whole thing down. There's a comment here about Wim Hof. There's really a bumping up of the ability of the body to withstand extremes of sensation and to, in a sense, you know, widen the window of tolerance in the nervous system, but also just reset the baseline of what feels ordinary to the body. I don't know the neurological details exactly of what he's proposing, and it seems in a very simple way, just from watching his descriptions of it and what he does with it, you know, runs really long races in the heat without getting exhausted and runs up mountains without extra oxygen and swims under icy lakes, you know, things like that, that, you know, it's having the effect of bringing a kind of inner heat. Of course, this is what the word tummo in the Tibetan refers to, and this is a tummo type breath that he's using. It's bringing an inner heat that changes our really how we process sensation, basically. And so, the comment is, you know, positive. This is a good phrase, right? Positive biological stress. This is true in all of the intense breathing practices, and it's true in a certain way in Vipassana itself, that part of what we're doing is a kind of exposure therapy where we expose our beings to a safe stimulus that starts to teach us both to tolerate more sensation and to tolerate more of a certain kind of stress. Holding the breath by itself does that, you know, that holding the breath at the bottom of the exhale, where you're really waiting for breath hunger to push on you a little bit. That is doing that in a very gentle way. It's a little bit stressful for the nervous system, right? If you give someone a mixture that has more carbon dioxide than usual in the air to breathe, it will induce a kind of panic attack that is not fear-based at all. Like it doesn't do anything into the amygdala, which is usually the fear center. It's purely physiological. The body does not want to be deprived of oxygen. And so even when it's totally safe, carbon dioxide therapy, which is a thing now, has this purpose of gently and safely stressing out the body so that it resets its sense of what's tolerable, and the window of tolerance can actually widen, and the ability to withstand stronger sensation, to withstand discomfort, and to move energy in a way that wasn't previously available can then become available. So, all right, so to recap, you can use any of these stronger pranayamas or volitional breaths, both in the context of the foundations of mindfulness of breathing, setting yourself up for a just observing the breath practice, but you can also use them as levers, particularly for the strong energetic hindrances, sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry. And generally, I'm going for balanced energy through the body mind, slightly lifted. For me, I want balanced slightly higher than the middle of the spectrum, whatever that is, right? You need some virya, chutzpah. I'm going to say virya and chutzpah are related. Happy high holidays to all the Jewish sangha and friends present and nearby. And that these practices can actually be really supportive then of the deepening in tranquility and focus that leads to rapture and absorption. All right, stopping there for now. Blessings.